Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast.
John!
Hey, how are you doing, Jesse?
Good. I have to start with John! John Galloway is a tech evangelist at Microsoft. He's focused on web development in Azure. I'm pleased and proud to say he's been a friend for how long have we known each other? Since 2005?
It seems like
something like that?
Yeah, yeah.
Long time. It feels longer than it was. Anyway, these days you are focused on Azure Functions. So maybe you could tell me a little bit about what that is.
Yeah, well, in my group at Microsoft, I've been working on app service stuff, and we've been working with customers and, you know, kind of fly in and work with them for a bit on a project. It's been really fun. And one of the things we've been helping them with has been functions, and it's been neat because it's really quick and simple to, you know, do something useful. You know, like some of these things we'll do like a 2-day hack fest, and we'll say, you have this existing application and it's running on your own server and it's not scalable and it's, you know, whatever kind of problems they're trying to move to the next step. And in a lot of cases, rather than, you know, doing everything in a big monolithic web app, we've been spinning things off into Azure Functions. And then those are doing kind of really lightweight tasks. And then the web application really turns out to be more of like a dashboard or, you know, showing results or progress.
So help me understand. The Azure function is a chunk of code that's running on Azure independent of any container?
Yeah. So the idea kind of, as we kind of get smaller and smaller, right? So you can start with something like a whole virtual machine. You can host a virtual machine and, you know, in Azure and other cloud providers, right? And that, but in that case, you're running a whole VM and you've got to deal with all the kinds of things, you know, security patches and, you know, it's a whole machine, right? So then shrinking down a bit, you get to more platform as a service offerings. And one of those is Azure App Service. And the idea there is you're running a website. Right. And so it's hosting your web app. And it feels to me kind of similar to, you know, how we used to do with like a shared web host, where you would get web hosting, you'd get like a little folder you could FTP stuff into, and then it, you know, it ran your website, but you knew you were kind of splitting your cost amongst other people, right? You know, several other websites. So, and that's a much simpler step already, because I'm not worried about patches or, you know, server uptime or all that kind of stuff. Like it's just a magical folder in the cloud where I put stuff and there's my website. And then of course with that, then App Service adds on to the simple shared hosting kind of scenario. You've got things like, you know, scaling and deployment slots and, you know, all kinds of other things that you can kind of scale up from and scale down from as well. So that's nice. But what we've seen, you know, personally,
I just heard Scott Guthrie shriek. Nice. That's nice.
It's amazing. It's
that's
wonderful.
That's where we made our reputation, man.
Well, you know, I honestly, when Azure first came out, I was a little frustrated with it because it was all this web roles and cloud roles and workers and what. And I was like, look, this is way more complicated than my simple, like, you know, FTP my stuff up to a folder and my site's running. Like I don't have to re-architect everything. Like I want that simple. So when it was originally called Azure Websites, when that came out, I was like, this is what I wanted from day one, right? You know, so it is my favorite thing on Azure. But we've noticed people are spinning up websites that are not really like the website. They don't need a whole website for it. And sometimes it's something like you've got, you know, like a web dashboard, but really it's just handling like processing of files, or you're uploading a say an image to a website, and the website's got to run this background task. It's got to resize the image and put a watermark on it and, you know, deal with it. And then when it's ready, it'll show up in the website. Mm-hmm. And for that kind of thing, that actually, like, that's hard to do in a website, because web applications are designed to get a request, do something quick, send a response, you know, and then go to sleep. Like, and so this long running process and making sure that something's actually working and all that, that's hard. And then as far as the being economical, that's not great either, because you're paying for more server resources than you really need to. So the idea with functions, or sorry, there's one step in between. It's called web jobs. So web jobs is something they introduced a while ago, and that hosts the kind of background processing stuff in a smarter way. So we saw people, you know, doing a lot of like jumping through hoops and trying to do things. I've written blog posts going back, you know, 10 years of here's how to run, you know, timers and, you know, like all this crazy stuff in order to keep a process running and check if it's done. And if your server restarts, we'll recover from that and all that. So what a web job does is it's a very simple, like you can think of it like a console application, and it will, you know, it does a process. It could be, it's not intended to be long, long running, but it's longer than request response kind of stuff. So the final evolution and where functions is we saw that people were building, you know, web apps, or they're spinning up whole app service on Azure, and all it was doing was running a web job. And we also saw that there's still some things you can get wrong with that kind of thing. It can be a little tricky to just background processing and this kind of functions in the cloud thing is harder than you'd think. So what they did with Azure Functions, the whole idea is you write literally a function. You can have a function that just says, a very simple case, I send it something, it formats it and returns it. Or that case I said before, I upload an image to it. So I post an image to it and it says great. And it does, you know, does whatever kind of resizing and watermarking, and then it returns a response.
So these are things that don't necessarily have a consumer facing front end.
They don't have a consumer facing front end. So they do have an available HTTP endpoint. So you can call them via, you know, a URL, but you're not really expected to do that most of the time. You could do it from like a, you know, from JavaScript in a web app. And I've seen people, you know, that have built things where, say, an Angular app is, you know, kicking off a function when you click on something. But we've also seen them for things where people are just kind of hooking little Lego parts together, you know. So one of the most fun ones I worked on was we went and worked with some startups up in San Francisco, and there are a bunch of different small teams, and I work with a team called Hixo, and they had it's a little device that wraps into a martial artist, MMA or boxer or whatever, wraps into their gloves. And it's, you know, it's small. It's like smaller than a flash drive, right?
Okay.
And it has sensors in it that'll measure, you know, impact and which it knows like which hand, how fast, how hard the impact is, that kind of stuff. And it was communicating with Bluetooth to an iPhone. And that's great. You know, a single fighter can go and they can, you know, practice, or they can be in a fight, and then they can look at their phone and say, okay, here's my stats. And, you know, maybe my I'm pulling my right or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. But the problem is your data is only ever on your phone. You're not sharing your data with anyone else. You know, there's a lot of things you could do where, say, in a gym, you've got a coach teaching a lot of, you know, fighters as they're practicing, and it'd be great if they could see everybody's, you know, results or something.
Right.
Or you lose your phone, you know, and you've lost all your data. And there's all kinds of other scenarios like this where it's like, yeah, we'd actually like this data to not just live on the device. So what we worked with them to do in the course of just a few days was, we had the data upload from the iPhone to an Azure storage queue, which is just a very simple, you know, it's a queue. And then we built functions that started doing all kinds of neat things with it. So, you know, the functions would trigger off of the queue whenever something came in. Then we would, you know, push it up into Power BI and do analytics. We would group a bunch of them together and, you know, return averages to an Angular dashboard and all that kinds of stuff. The neat thing with that was that the web application was actually incredibly light, because it was just showing this kind of rolled up data, and, you know, the functions are able to kind of respond to all these little events and start pushing data around. And then, you know, some of the advantages of that are, number one, functions have and web jobs also, functions run on top of web jobs. I should have said that earlier. So functions are kind of like a simplified abstraction on top of web jobs. So the neat thing with that is they have bindings, and you can say, you can write your function, and you can say, as one of the input parameters, you can say, this is a queue binding and this is the name. And then you've configured that name. And so then whenever something's added to a queue by that name, it automatically, the function will kick off, and that parameter is already populated by the data in that queue. So it's kind of, it's one of the things where it's like, it's a lot easier to see. If you go to functions.azure.com, you can kind of click through one in a matter of like a couple of minutes and you're running one. But the idea is, yeah, a lot of the time your function code is like 5-10 lines of code long. And so the idea is, you know, it is productive because you're not writing all that code that says, okay, go, you know, I don't know, poll for this thing, make, you know, keep checking until there's new data. Okay, there's new data. Now read the data out. Now format it. Now, none of that code's required, right? I just have a parameter that's got the name of a queue and boom, there it is. And you can trigger to all kinds of different things. You can trigger to, there's things like, you know, OneDrive bindings and box, you know, tons of different stuff. You can trigger to pretty much anything that's got like a web sort of endpoint.
So let's talk physically about these functions. Are they, what can they be written in any language, or are they typically written in JavaScript, or are they literally functions, or tell me a little bit more about what their shape is?
Okay, so the languages they support, they've got C#, F#, Node.js, Python, PHP, Batch, Bash, and then you can do like an EXE, like a Windows EXE. And then they also have, and I'm not sure if it's out yet, but I saw that they had announced or put on a GitHub thing recently, and I think it may already be live, that you could also bind to, you know, basically any CLR assembly. So you could also do like VB.NET or whatever.
People still do that? Okay.
Yeah. There's, you know, it's surprising. I mean, you don't hear about it as much, but there are tons of people that I talk to regularly that, you know, enterprise and stuff, there's large existing applications still in VB.NET. So.
Yeah, but are there large, I know we just went on a tangent. Are there large enterprise applications that are still being built in VB.NET, or are they being maintained?
Well, combination, right? I mean, if you've got, say, a bunch of business logic that's in a VB.NET assembly that's got 10,000 lines of code, and, you know, it's got something like validation or whatever. I was just working with somebody yesterday, and actually I have no idea, that code could have been VB or C# or whatever, but they were doing some stuff. They had a large amount of existing code. They wanted to rewrite as little as possible, and they wanted to see how to use it in a function, you know? And so I was kind of working with them as far as how, you know, what's the simplest way to do that. Mm-hmm. But so it is, the idea of being able to use any CLR language is a nice thing. So, and you know, I mentioned a few of the triggers. You know, there's like the queue and stuff like that, but there's the HTTP trigger, which is really powerful. So the idea is you can just make an HTTP request from, you know, anything, a mobile app, a web application, that will ping a function and say, do something, you know? So that's pretty neat. And you can also do a timer trigger. So the idea there is like a cron job kind of thing. Well, so the neat thing with the timer trigger is you can do things like run a SQL query to clean up data in your database, you know, every day at midnight, something that simple. We worked with somebody, I was over in Russia in December, and one of the teams I advised, they were doing some neat things with SQL Server reporting services reporting, and they were generating a bunch of reports and creating PDFs and emailing them out. And those happened, I think there was a timer, and there was also when orders were coming in. And so those, you know, both the timer and the order being created would ping a function, and then the function would kick off the reporting service thing and create, and then email off the reports using, I think they use, I don't know, MailChimp or whatever. So
okay, so let me see if I'm getting this. The idea is that you have an extremely lightweight connective tissue that allows you to get rid of the much bigger, more cumbersome structure of having a whole website or web foobar.
Yeah, well, so it's website, or it's, you know, back end process. It's a service or a console application running on some machine that we hope never gets unplugged, you know?
Right. So what if I'm building a forms over data application, and the server is a, you know, essentially a SQL server that's doing some logic and manipulation and then feeding that data to me. And then I'm doing something on the client and then posting it back to the server. Would this simplify things for me? Is it totally irrelevant to me? How does that fit together?
You know, for the simple case you're describing, I wouldn't see anything that jumps out to me immediately for functions. It would be more kind of like background processing or, you know, some sort of long running thing. It could be something where, say, you're uploading data and it's in the background, it's maybe checking and saying like, you know, checking on order status or shipping or something like that, right? So you go through and you're filling in your data, and then it's maybe watching in the background and saying like, hey, your processing on your thing is complete, and it's sending you an email, or it's doing a little Ajax banner at the top of your screen saying like, you know, order completed, click here or something.
Right. So it could work with some kind of, I'm very mobile focused, so it could work with some kind of push notification to say that work is done.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we did some stuff using, going back to that thing with that fighter IoT thing, was, you know, it was reading the data, and it was using SignalR to push data to an Angular dashboard kind of thing. So there could be multiple fighters, and it's showing averages and, you know, graphics and stuff like that. That could be on a huge, you know, it could be on a scoreboard or something. So
what's the learning curve like to understand this and to build with this?
So that's one of the fun things, is that in order to, like, you can go to functions.azure.com, and they have a very quick start where it'll say, you know, do you want to create, you know, a timer, or do you want to create, so there's a few different, like, it's a timer, data processing, or webhook. And then the two languages are either C# or JavaScript. So you click on that, you say create function, and then it says pick an auth provider. So you just have to log in as somebody. And the options there are Microsoft account, Google account, or Facebook. And, you know, part of the reason for this is just to make sure you're a real person and not a robot in the cloud spinning up functions to rig elections or do something crazy.
Yeah, nobody would do that.
So
you have been in Russia a lot, haven't you?
So once you do that, then you've got a working function, and you basically click run, and you will see the lines of code that you've got there is, it's like three lines. It's a function with a declaration, and it's logging something out. And so learning curve, if you know, you know, C#, JavaScript, F#, blah, 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 like all that list, you can go through and start playing with it in a matter of like literally like a minute or two. And so I think that's really one of the big parts, like especially for something like a hackathon or a, you know, a business saying like, hey, we've got nothing in the cloud and we want to look at a baby step. Like, this is a great case where instead of saying like, okay, we're going to rewrite our, you know, line of business application, our bread and butter applications to, you know, run in the cloud, how about we just automate this stupid report we've got to run once a month? You know what I mean? Right, like, right. Just use it for some very simple, like, kick off a report, do this thing every time something's checked into GitHub, post, you know, like just wire together some very simple stuff, and there's no risk to it. It's a, you know, it's fun to play with. And then you can kind of say like, okay, now this is working. Now I can go forward. And the cool thing is there's a few, like, if you've got something that's working and you want to take further steps, some of the neat things with it is, one is it's running on top of the whole app service infrastructure. So you can click on the function app settings, and then you can go in and you can say, okay, I would like to set up continuous integration, or I would like to, you know, set up configure authentication so that it requires authentication to kick it off. Or I would like to go into the whole app service settings and, you know, tweak it using, you know, whatever else there. So that's pretty cool. and then another place that you can kind of go forward with it is, there are tools for functions for Visual Studio, and there's also tools for, there's a an NPM-based CLI for it. So the idea with that is, you, like, the easy button is functions.azure.com, and you click around in a web portal and you write some code. But you can also write that code in, you know, in any editor. There's Visual Studio tools, like I was saying, or you can using the NPM CLI, you can scaffold up an application. And then you can hook up that code to continuous deployment. So you can go into, you know, you point your function at your GitHub repo, you push your Visual Studio code, you know, you type in Visual Studio, you commit your code to GitHub, and the function is automatically updated. So that's usually what we try and get to, like, for a few day hackfest, is we'll start with, you know, the first couple of hours. It's like, hey, we just wrote a few functions. We just automated this stuff. This thing's pushing here and going there. Okay, great. Now let's get this code under source control. Let's get this, you know, like, you know, follow some like more pro.
Right. I was going to say professionalize it and
exactly.
Put it under authorization and source control and so forth. Yep. But so great. I have a good sense of why it's cool and that it's lightweight and that I can get started at what was the website?
Functions.azure.com. You know, one other thing. Sorry, there's one other thing. And I apologize for sounding like a salesman. It's super fun. I've been having tons of fun with this lately. And it's like when you go and like working on something like a hackathon or when you're just trying to do a proof of concept, it's frustrating when you spend the whole first day or a half a day like setting up your build process or, you know, like all this like stuff and you're not actually writing usable code.
Right.
And so it's so nice to strip away all those layers and you're looking at a single function or, you know, a couple of functions on a page and you're just like, take this, do this thing, and, you know, like strip away all the other kind of busy work, you know?
Yeah.
So the one other thing that's a very nice feature of it is since it is lightweight, the billing for it can be crazy cheap. And there's a blog post, Troy Hunt, he does that haveibeenpwned.com website, which is, you can type in your email address and it'll say like, has an account with a password with this email address been leaked on the internet? Uh-huh. And it's pretty straight, you know, like you're definitely in there. Pretty much everyone's in there somewhere. And so anyhow, he did a bunch of automation stuff using Azure Functions. He did something where if somebody is abusing his APIs, he checks for that and then he sends it up to his Cloudflare to blacklist that IP. And so he wrote that logic in Functions and it came out to something silly, like 30 cents a month. Wow. And so he goes through and explains, you know, how he wrote it and like all this, how hugely it's decreased the load on his servers and all that. And then he's like, the billing for it is just ridiculously cheap, because it really is optimized around spin up, run a function, shut down. And the one.
So is this a gateway drug to Azure? Is that what this is? I start off really cheap and then I want to build out around that?
You know, I mean, obviously, I think some of the idea hopefully is if part of Azure is working well for you, then you would consider it for other things. But you don't have to use anything else. Like literally, like these guys who we're working with this MMA glove, they don't have to do anything else with Azure ever, you know, and they've already got their data is like up in the cloud and available from an HTTP endpoint, you know. Mm-hmm. Gateway drug is makes it sound bad, right? Like you're hooked on it and you can't get away from it. Mm-hmm. The idea here really, especially with Functions, is it is pretty lightweight. If you want to go back to a console application, you know, you could without a huge amount of work. But and there is also support for there's a Functions runtime that you can download and run locally, which is, which is nice.
Yeah. So you can build something in Visual Studio, run it locally, and then push it up.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah.
So those of us who are building applications that are not principally in the cloud are falling mm-hmm. further and further behind. And yet you seem to be simplifying things as you go. So what if people want to begin to explore Azure and begin to explore the idea of putting applications into the cloud, is this a good starting point?
Well, I sure think so. And part of this has been from the point of view of like actually working with these companies, right? And we've seen places where, you know, like I was saying, they're hesitant to like, oh man, we don't want to move our whole big web app, our front end web app, or even some of our back end stuff. Like that's really important. But this stupid stuff of like kicking off an email once every night, that's a pretty easy way to get started, right? And then you can kind of go in and be like, okay, what was our bill for the month? Okay, that's reasonable. What was our, you know, like you can make sure it's working for you, right? And then once you've got that under your belt, then you can kind of see if you want to move more of your stuff to the cloud. And we've definitely seen that with people we've been working with. So.
Very cool. Very cool. So,
yeah.
So a question that came up on the internet that I've been pondering a lot is whether programming over the past decade has gotten harder. Certainly there are more pieces to deal with, or it's gotten easier. And this would be a good example of where it's gotten easier, where the back end is doing a lot more work for you. And so what's your sense? What's the direction we're heading in? Is it more complexity and more difficult, or is it, yeah, there's more complexity, but that's simplifying complexity. And so it gets easier to do certain things.
That is not an easy question. I think that over time, the answer is yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
So I think that the problems are definitely getting harder, right? There's everything's on the internet, and so we have to worry about security. We have to ship much more quickly because everything's on phones and internet, as opposed to shipping a, you know, an update to our customers, you know, whether it's an installer or a box or whatever. Like, that's gotten harder. Expectations are harder. Building for multiple form factors is harder. Building for multiple operating systems harder. So all the, there's a lot more challenges.
Well, that's one level of harder. But the other, I don't mean to interrupt you, but another level of harder is that there are so many component pieces to put together. I mean, you start rattling off Azure and Angular and Grunt and Gulp it's hard to keep up with even what all the various pieces are. But there's, it seems like what has happened is that the pieces that we used to work with in an integrated environment are now being decomposed into more specialized pieces. So there are a lot more of them, but they're mm-hmm. smaller. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. And, you know, so yes, it can be a challenge keeping up with them, but I would say that all those pieces are the solution to the multiple challenges, right? All of those different parts, you know, like you mentioned, say any of those, Angular, right? Angular solves specific problems that we ran into with building front-end heavy web applications, where we were, you know, having to write a ton of custom code that we wrote and managed ourselves. Like, that was hard work. And, you know, it's nice to have a framework that handles a lot of those common concerns, right? I mean, and so you can look kind of across the board at all those different things where, you know, Grunt and Gulp, those are build processes. People didn't just write them because they were like, wanted to make things harder, right? They wrote them to solve problems where we've got all these different JavaScript libraries that we're integrating, that we're, you know, integrating together, that we need to make sure the dependencies are matched, that we are, you know, in some cases, cross-compiling from different meta languages into JavaScript, CSS, HTML, that we're optimizing, that we're bundling and packaging, that we're running unit tests on. So JavaScript got away from very simple little scripts that, you know, what could go wrong, to they're fundamental to our application. So we need these kind of build systems, you know, and automation systems for front end. So, you know, pretty much all those different things, I think it can be overwhelming, but it also, it's nice to look at them as they're tools and they solve problems. And if it is nice to keep up with them for the same reason as, like, you want to learn different software development patterns, right?
Yes.
You don't have to learn all those patterns, but knowing some of those patterns can help you out when you run into a problem and you go like, oh, I know this. Like, this is a solved problem. There's a way, you know, other people have run into this and they've solved this a specific way, right? So yes.
But the surface area of what you need to know has gotten really large. And if you want to switch, so you're a web programmer and you want to become a mobile programmer or vice versa, the learning curve from zero is pretty steep.
Yes and no. I feel like the difference between all these different developer types has gotten less. For instance, if you're a web developer and you want to write a desktop app, there's a lot of, you know, there's NativeScript, there's Electron, there's Cordova, you know, there's just tons of different systems that you can use to target. So, like, if you're a web developer, you can target all kinds of different things now. Yeah. Especially, like, if you're a web developer, there's a good chance you know some JavaScript, and, you know, Node, NPM, all that is everywhere. If you're a C# developer, heck, it's hard to think of what you can't run C# on these days.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean?
And if you can't, there's TypeScript, which is mm-hmm. about 5 minutes of learning from C#.
Exactly. Which, by the way, congrats on your new course.
Thank you very much.
So, but that's an example too, right? Where it's like, I see, it's true, there's a lot of stuff out there, but I'm seeing that these different areas are becoming more similar. And so, you know, if you've got, there are some kind of fundamental areas to keep up with, you know, there's, mm-hmm. you want to have a good general purpose language that's going to run most of the places you'll want to take it. To me, the main ones I see, JavaScript and C#, those just feel like they run everywhere, and you can target pretty much anything with them. So that's why I'm focusing on those lately. Mm-hmm. Or always.
Yeah.
But they do feel like really good general purpose languages that I can jump in anywhere and do something useful.
Well, you made a very strong point before, and I don't want to let it get lost, which is that if we took the technology we have now and set out to solve the problems we were solving 5 years ago, life would be, it would be much easier than it was 5 years ago. I mean, infinitely easier than it was 5 years ago. But, but we're not solving those problems today. We're solving much harder problems today. And so we're always kind of on the bleeding edge, and therefore it all seems like things are getting more difficult. But it, but if you hold the problem space steady, then things are getting easier.
I think that's true. I think we're getting aware of more too. I think developers may be more exposed to multiple, like, I think there were probably times where in the past where you could be a, you could work in financials, you know, on a mainframe, and that's all you did for your whole career. And that would be a good full career. And or, you know, you write printer drivers, or you write web applications, you know, in a back end and whatever, but I don't feel like people crossed over as much. And there's more of a feeling lately where you're expected to be able to kind of jump around more. And so I guess my point there is I think we're maybe aware of more challenges than we used to be. Well, so part of my thinking with that is when I was first starting programming, I wasn't aware of all these patterns, right? And then over time, I got exposed to more different patterns, and people were like, hey, you know, you should use this pattern. Finally, I broke down and bought a book. And then I was all of a sudden, I was like, oh, there's all this stuff around here that I've been klutzing my way through, you know, like just making stuff up as I went along. And so for the same thing, it's like there have been people solving a lot of these problems for a while, but just kind of off in their own silos. And now we're kind of getting more exposed to, you know, like, for instance, there were developers working on Outlook Web and Google Maps and stuff like that that were building single page apps for a very long time.
Yes.
But most of us weren't, you know, and so we just weren't exposed to the complexities there.
Well, I think one of the conundrums for Microsoft is that if they didn't evolve new things, then they'd be sitting on their monopoly and people would be all upset with them. And if they do develop new things, it's like, well, it's overwhelming and I have to learn all these. So to some degree, you can't win. It is astounding how much Microsoft turns out in terms of new technologies and new ways of doing things on a year, not even yearly, on a, I don't know, what is it, weekly basis, that there's some new piece of technology or some new technique or new development environment. I mean, it really is a machine for turning that out.
Well, I feel like that's just the software world as a whole. And in some ways, Microsoft could be a bubble before where it was like, hey, we can just focus on our, you know what I mean? You could just be a Microsoft developer and you would get the new version of Visual Studio every couple of years. And that was about all you had to learn, you know, and you can get by with that now, but really, you know, the whole software world as a whole is just moving really quickly. So I think Microsoft is trying to be where the customers are demanding that they be, you know, and so there are both, there's different ends of the spectrum. There's some customers that want stability and support. And, you know, that's definitely a strong point of Microsoft's, is they'll ship and support things for a long time. And I regularly still get, you know, questions on internal message boards and stuff of large, you know, whatever it is, web forms, applications, doing things. And I'm like, man, I kind of remember doing this stuff, you know, but so, I mean, there's that kind of long-term support and that kind of, I don't want things to change and, or I want things to be very controlled. Microsoft has to keep those customers happy, right? But they also do have, you know, like, they do have customers that are like, look, if it's web forms or Node, I'm going to Node 5 years ago, right? Or whatever it is, you know, or, you know, if it's web forms controls or, you know, React and Angular. So Microsoft absolutely, to be relevant, needs to be in those places as well. So I think the challenge always is to, you know, honestly and legitimately serve both ends of that spectrum and everything in between.
Yes. One of the things that I get asked a lot or hear discussions about a lot are, why isn't there as much drag and drop programming as there used to be? Why is it so much harder now to build controls and objects and user interface pieces than it was even 5 years ago? And that speaks to the web forms. I mean, there were certainly problems with web forms. But if you think back to like Silverlight, we had Blend and you could just drag your controls over and tweak them. And a lot of that has gone away.
It kind of has. And it's, you know, a part of it is that it's really hard to do in order to do drag and drop and have a single control that you can set properties on, and it's just the problem is it's got to know the entire stack. It's got to it's got to have a pretty constrained like problem space it's solving for, and you know what I mean. So yes. As you start moving into there was Ajax Control Toolkit, and then there were jQuery. There were some controls that ran on top of jQuery UI and stuff like that. And I don't know. It's just it's really hard. And there are component vendors that continue to sell, you know, components that kind of give you more of that experience. But it really is, I think, hard to build a great application or even a good application that's drag and drop now. The one place that I do still see some potential for that is something like React, and potentially even Angular. And the reason for that is that they're built more Angular 2 and React are built using components. Web components. And so you do end up getting, you know, there is kind of enough like state and, you know, somebody smart could potentially make something more drag and drop for that. But it does feel like for the most part, in order to hook all these different parts together, and they're moving so quickly as well, you know.
Yes.
So in other words, I write some amazing drag and drop, you know, UI experience for, you know, version one of Angular and Angular 2 ships, you know, or right, whatever right, it is. Exactly. It's really hard to keep up with that too.
And all of this is just in the .NET world. I mean, I have not written a line of PHP or Ruby. I have no experience with that at all. And I know there are lots of .NET programmers who do. But my point is that there's so much going on in the .NET world that mm-hmm. can keep you completely consumed. And even then, you're not going to keep up with everything that's going on. And so, to some degree, I know more and more about less and less. And you know, the old line is, soon I'll know everything about nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think there's got to be a good point, right, where you get to have more of a general feel of like, okay, I'm jumping into this new area, and you know, here's what I need to know to get started. And here's some, like, some obvious concerns I have are, you know, like security, performance, whatever, like, you know, does it work for, I mean, so there's some standard questions you're going to ask wherever you go, whatever platform you're working on. Right. But then there's a lot where you just have to do more page fault learning, where it's just kind of like, I, you know, pretty much for nothing I speak about do I feel like I'm an expert, you know? I just have to be like, okay, I don't know the answer, but I know where to go for that, you know, or yeah. I know who to ask, or I know, you know.
I love that term, page fault learning. That's brilliant. That's what we're doing, all right. So what about you? How are you spending your time? Are you spending most of it going around and teaching people about the functions, or what's it like being a Microsoft evangelist these days?
You know, it's very fluid. As a Microsoft evangelist, I've over mm-hmm. times, you know, like we're starting to think about the Build conference coming up, right? So there's things like, you know, with that, a lot of time I'll do stuff behind the scenes you'd never hear about, like, you know, putting together training material that other people will present, or so I have been doing more of this stuff of working directly with partners and going to these different hackfests and stuff. But who knows, that stuff really continues to change over time. So, you know, a lot of the idea is to be flexible and keep up to date technically, and then, you know, be flexible. Seriously, it's funny. People expect things are relatively still, like as far as huge secret stuff, things are relatively the world I work in with DevTools right. and stuff is pretty, like, you can look on the GitHub repositories and the commits, and, you know, a lot of time there's people in the community that know more than I do because they're following the issues on GitHub or whatever. And then as far as the Windows and you know, other, you know, I don't know, devices. I'm watching on Twitter and, like, chatting with other Hanselmen and people like, whoa, did you see that thing? That's crazy, you know? So, I mean, but you asked what I've been up to. I got to share one other fun. I've got three daughters, and each of them, I've kind of like pushed programming on the older two, not a bunch, but I've been like, hey, let's do this thing and I'll teach you some programming. My oldest daughter, I taught some HTML and JavaScript. My middle daughter took a Python course at school and I helped her with that. My youngest daughter kept asking, I want to build a video game. And actually the older two too, they'd be like, okay, I learned some programming, I want to make a video game. And I'd be like, I don't know how to make a video game. Like, sorry, you know, maybe someday we'll Yeah, we'll do that eventually. And I never did. So over December, that was one of the things on my list where I was like, I'm going to take some time and just do some non-work fun programming. So I was secretly off in my office, you know, hanging out and going through Unity tutorials. And my 9-year-old daughter comes in and she's very like pretty quick to pick up tech stuff. So she's watching over my shoulder and she's like, why'd you do that? That's kind of boring. And I'm like, well, I'm following the tutorial and, you know, it has you make a ball that you roll around and you hit these squares. And she's like, well, why are all the squares the same color? Well, because that's what the tutorial says. I'm just learning. She's like, can I switch seats with you? So she like switches in seats. So, and the neat thing with Unity, if you haven't done it before, and I'm like complete newbie, but I had a lot of fun with it, is you have this IDE where you go in and design things and set properties. And then when you want to program them, you click in it and it'll open in, depending on your environment, you've got configured either the Mono editor or Visual Studio. So boom, I'm over in Visual Studio writing C sharp code. So next thing I know, she's like, yeah, I don't want a ball. I want a shark that eats fish. So then I'm like, oh, how am I going to do that? You know? And so the neat thing that I found out was that, well, Unity doesn't have a thing where you can create your own models and, but it can import them in a lot of standard things. And there's different ones out there I've used before, like Blender, but Blender's complicated. And, you know, it's like, oh man, what can I use? There's Google SketchUp. And then somebody on Twitter recommended that I look at Paint 3D, which is a new app, a Windows app. And it worked perfectly. So they even had like a fish and a shark kind of shape. And we stretched them and set the colors and all that and loaded them in. So the next thing I know, we've got a fish or a shark swimming around eating fish. And then there were some hilarious things we did wrong where we like kept the physics That's still right. set to like tumble like a ball. So the shark is like tumbling around. And you know, if you go too far, you fall off the edge of the world and just fall forever. My oldest daughter came in and saw that and was like, well, I'd buy that game. So I think we're onto something.
Yeah, there you go. And all with Unity, which Laurent has been touting as a great way to get into HoloLens.
Yeah. So the neat thing with, there's definitely HoloLens, but one of the things that's so cool with it is that it can target pretty much everything. Like you can build apps for Kindle, Android, Windows phone, you know, Windows desktop, Steam, Xbox, like everywhere, you know. Steve Sanderson was telling me this past August when we were in NDC Sydney, and he was telling me about a game he built, a racing game that he's selling for iPhone and Android, and he built it all in Unity. So, I mean, it's that's part of the neat thing with it, right? Is you write one game and you kind of ship it everywhere. So